I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, I am joined by my first New Zealander, Barry Pearman. Thank you so much for being my first Kiwi, Barry.
Oh, it's good to be here. Yeah.
Barry's focus is on spiritual formation for mental health, and he's worked as a pastor, a chaplain, and a mental health support worker. And he also himself struggles with depression. And so I wanted to ask you, Barry, a little bit about your spiritual background and the significant role it may have played in your life, in your childhood, or in the things that you do now.
Yeah, so I was raised in a really neat Christian family, and my father was a farmer, a sheep farmer, which is quite a normal thing in New Zealand. And my parents were very much, very good, strong Christians. My mother actually had depression, though, and I suppose her having that, and also a number of people in our congregation and our neighbours, they also had mental health difficulties. And I suppose that was the very first sort of introduction without me even realizing it. And then later on in life, I had a real, got a really interest in mental health, and I became a support worker and doing work at the coalface with people with, very serious mental health issues such as psychosis, schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, personality disorders, that sort of thing. But as I was doing that work, supporting people in their recovery, one of the things I observed was that a lot of their spiritual needs weren't being met by the churches that were around them. In particular, really, the churches found it difficult to connect with them. Mm. And sometimes could be quite patronizing, or stigmas existed. Mm. And it was a real struggle for them to marry their faith and their journey of mental unwellness together. And I observed this for quite a few years. So back in 1999, last millennia, an opportunity arose where a church was wanting to connect really quite deeply with people with mental health struggles. And they found that they couldn't do that within the constructs of what they were doing. And so they advertised for a person to be a community chaplain, particularly with the emphasis to helping people with mental illness and also other disabilities to connect well and to grow in their faith. And so I started there. And we developed our own church service called The Living Room, which is on a Tuesday night. And my role was pastor come chaplain. And it grew and grew and grew. And for some people, think, well, that's very stigmatizing to do that sort of thing. But actually, what happened was that we would encourage people to come on Tuesday night, but also to connect in with the local churches where they were, as well as possible. And part of my role was to actually help people to do that, mm. and to facilitate education, I suppose, and to help people get into roles within their local churches. Even if it wasn't the church that I was a part of, they might go off to another church on a Sunday. But for the most part, many of the people that came on a Tuesday night really found it empowering. Mm. And we would do things like have people sharing time. They would be involved in leading the worship or playing the music. Even one for a period, I had people preaching the sermon, and which was absolutely probably one of the best things I've ever done. And people were able to relate some of the struggles they had with their faith. Mm-hmm. And it was just beautiful to see people with personality disorders or people that were hearing voices able to speak from scripture into other people's lives that were struggling with this very, very same thing. And it was a wonderful thing. Yeah.
You know, I heard the most interesting thing, and you'll have to tell me what you think about this, because it reminds me in different cultures, like cultures that are, I'll say, less modern, you could say, or have more shamanistic type religious practice. Yeah. Things like schizophrenia and personality disorders will come up, but sometimes these people are seen as holy men. And have you heard of this phenomenon?
I have.
And not to say that they don't suffer or that not to minimize anybody's suffering or genuine chemical imbalances and things like that that could be helped by regular medicine. But the idea that they still belong to their tribe and that they contribute and that they belong, they're not ostracized. They're seen as influential in their tribe and having a different sort of role and a specialness to them. I can't help but to think that your community provided a kind of safe space, but like a special space that people could participate in their own gifting, no matter what was troubling them. And you know, with something like schizophrenia, where they might have audio hallucinations or something like that, where they would still be received and accepted in the community, they could really shine potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And just looking at that example of, I think of this one particular lady who struggled with psychosis and hearing voices. And we talked about, we went through the Beatitudes, and I said, you pick a Beatitude that really speaks to you. And she said, I want to speak on the meek shall inherit the earth. Mm. Okay. And this was a lady who I would say was some days Catholic, some days New Age, some days was quite, there was levels of unwellness, highly supported. And so I sat down with her and we discussed, I gave her some context around what meek was, and we wrote a sermon together. And she said, so meekness is like bridling a horse. I said, yeah, that's right. So one of the things I've learned is I've had to learn how to get control over my voices, and just like a bridle of a horse. And so we wrote a sermon, just a short 15-minute sermon about that. And she was able to speak far more powerfully than I could have if I'd done that message. And she went away buzzing. She took the sermon and gave it to her parents and handed it on to all of her neighbors. And she was just gave such a great deal of encouragement.
Wow. Yeah. And she could really speak her story. And it made, you know, it was like something she could model. She could really model it. That's really fascinating. Yeah. And when you think about it, what she's experiencing isn't that much different than, I mean, a lot of us hear voices, we just know that it's not, I mean, we all have an inner dialogue too, and we have, it's different than psychosis, but that we can kind of imagine what that could be like, and that we also have to work on taming that inner voice as well. Yeah.
I ran a course for our church about mental health, and I had a guy come who struggled with voices. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, I'll demonstrate what it's like. Mm. And so he grabbed someone from the audience and sat them down, and then he walked around behind them yelling into the ears. And it's like, wow, that's a big picture. a wonderful movie. I don't know whether you've seen it. It's called Lars and the Real Girl. Have you seen
it? Yes, I have.
Yeah. Which is a story of this guy with very strong delusional disorder. But the whole of the community accepted him for him for what it was, and wrapped a lot of love and support around him, and he was able to break free from that way of thinking. And I think that was a wonderful movie.
I really love it too. He walked all the way through his delusion. They just walked with him. And then he didn't need it anymore. And it was like, it was really sweet. And I thought, I mean, at first you're thinking, wait a minute, what? and then you realize that somebody's figured it out. Somebody's figured out what's happening with this poor guy. And then everybody's like, okay, we'll do it. We're going to walk with him. And then you realize that that's actually what we should be doing with people. Like that's kind of the amazing thing about, changing how we stigmatize people. I have, my son has autism and he wasn't able to speak for a long time. So stigma is like right in the forefront of my mind too, and how it changes people and how it puts people outside. And of course you can be put on the outside for mental illness, for looking differently, for speaking differently, for the color of your skin or for where you're from. But, it can, create mental health issues or make certain ones worse, because we're such social creatures, so bonded to each other.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And currently I'm sort of flogging my way through the story of the man in the ditch, which is what I call the Good Samaritan, the story of the Good Samaritan. And it's absolutely that whole case of asking people, are you going to get in the ditch, or are you going to keep on walking by or ignoring those sorts of things?
The Good Samaritan sees himself as the man in the ditch, and your website is called Turning the Page, turningthepage.info, and maybe can talk about some of what you're after with those efforts. What are some of the things you're doing? What are some of the aims of that website and those efforts?
Okay, well, it's just my big tagline is discovering mental health through spiritual formation. So what I'm wanting to do is really help people who are struggling, pretty much what I did within the living room, the church service that we have, but helping them to find some mental health through connecting their spirituality. And so we expand on scriptures. We talk about faith journeys, all that sort of thing. So, that's what I do.
Whatever happened to the living room? Whatever became of it? How long did it go on?
I ran it for, led it for 13 years, so which is quite a long time.
Yeah, that is.
And I suppose it's like, you know, when you're working at the coalface, and it was the coalface, you eventually take a lot of coal dust in. And I just sense the Lord saying, you've got to move on. Do something else. So, and when I left, I handed it back to the church, and really I've not really kept up with it. I've had a few people from those days, they still chat to me online, but other than that, I don't think it's going anymore, though. It's certainly not going in the form that I was running it in anyway.
You don't hear about those types of ministries. At least I don't. I don't know if it's a thing in New Zealand, but I certainly don't hear about them very often.
No, I think it's very rare what we did. Very, very rare. Yeah.
And so with your own struggle with depression, did this begin like in your adolescence, or was this after a while into adulthood?
I think it's always been there for a very long time. But it didn't surface itself really until around about 2010, when I was in ministry, and a lot of the stresses and stuff just got on top of me. And And I went to my GP and he suggested we try some medication. It was like the fog being lifted. And I started to say, oh, gosh, things are different to the way I've always thought it was.
Oh, wow.
And so, and depression can be like that. You don't realize you're in it.
Right, right. Because your frame of reference, you wouldn't have any other frame of reference.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
That's really interesting. And did it, so did it change your whole quality of life then? Or you were like, well, this is interesting. I like life a lot more now, or?
Yeah, and I'm still on medication today, and it goes up and down, and depression goes up and down, and it has its own challenges. I'm just unique, just like everyone else is unique, you know.
Right. Yeah, depression can really have a lot of different forms, and certain things can trigger it as well. Like you were saying, you have a book that's available when people sign up at your website, and I was reading it, and it was talking about like things you can do to things that help make it better, things that can definitely make it worse. And I know that, there's a tendency for some people who don't understand it very well to think, oh, well, just do this thing and you can think your way out of it. You can do your way out of it.
Yeah.
Or just take this pill and you'll be better. But a lot of times, because we're so unique, there isn't any real magic bullet or anything. And some people simply can't like get out of bed. Like they just, it's really debilitating. But I appreciated your book quite a bit because it just offers a lot of different, a whole lot of different ideas. And I know you were really inspired and also went to the training by Larry Crabb. Maybe you could a little bit talk about some of the concepts and some of the things that have been most powerful to you from some of his teachings.
Oh, that's a big question.
That's a big one. Or just like, what spoke to you about his teachings that you would go ahead and take the training?
Well, when I first started in ministry, I needed to go and get some supervision. Mm-hmm. And the supervisor that I went to see, he was trained under Larry Crabb. And he handed me a book called Connecting. Mm-hmm. And in this book, can't quote word for word, but Larry says, underneath what society calls a psychological disorder is a soul crying for connection.
Mm.
Is a soul crying for only what community can provide, which is connection. And that just hit me bang, because this is what I had not seen. Well, in the sense that I've seen lots of people with mental illness and desperately wanting connection, but not getting deep soul-to-soul connection. And so that really generated a lot of power and strength for me to go into ministry. And as I sort of went into that, I kept on finding more and more material from Larry and others around spiritual formation, mental health. And often these weren't concepts that were particularly aimed at mental illness. They were just good concepts for everybody. Mm-hmm. But taking them further, putting them into the context of people, dealing with very high levels of mental unwellness. Well, what could we do? Okay, here's an example. Larry Crabb talks about having a compelling vision. And so I remember one particular guy who had a very strong gambling addiction. And I talked to him about a vision that I felt that God had given me for his life. So it would be that, and I wrote it down, and I said, in 5 years' time, I believe, this is how you could be, a man who has, knows brokenness, but also knows complete wholeness now, and that is living at peace with his wife, that has got his finances under control, that has just knows a deepness of relationship with Jesus. And a compelling vision, one that sort of draws you towards it. And so as I shared this, he was just absolutely moved and stumped. And I wrote it down and gave it to him. Now, was that going to happen in the next 24 hours? No, it wasn't. But I said, people can look at you right now and say, this is your lot, this is your mess, this is who you are. And they just get stuck into what that is now. But I am looking in 5 years' time who I believe you can be. If you really surrender your will and your life to Christ, you know, and we generally just keep on working day in, day out on these addiction sort of struggles. And he was deeply, deeply encouraged. You know, because people can so get stuck in the moment by moment now mess that they are in, that they lose sight of what can be in the future. So that's just one example of what I learned from Larry Crabb. Yeah.
That is so powerful. Yeah, well, what do you tell me how you mean you've written about it?
I've written some blog posts about it, so I can provide some links for that sort of stuff too.
That would be really good. I'll put those in the show notes because I didn't come across those myself, but I think people would love to hear that. There's this thing about a benediction or a good word. When you give people a good word, you are inviting them into seeing a new future, a new vision for their lives, and inviting them kind of on a journey that isn't there yet. But in a way, when you speak it out and you both decide to walk in that direction, then it can become real because you decide it does. You know, you commit to it. You know, it's like committing to, you know, if you're going to commit to walking somewhere, you can't walk in the other direction. You have to start walking in that direction. And there's something about that. Well, we'll get stuck thinking what we see now is real. It's only because we've decided that it is, that it's real. You know, I know a few people who want to quit smoking right now, and they've decided that they are smokers. That's it. I'm done. You know, I'm a smoker. I've always smoked since I was a young teenager. That's it. And I've tried and I can't quit. And I think, well, you're deciding that right now. But what if you decided, you know, for the next hour, I'm not a smoker. And then for the next hour after that, I'm not a smoker. You know, it's not like you have to decide for your entire life. It's just that you have to take one step in the right direction and envision the time when you won't do it anymore. And I think that we kind of pick the future that we, you know, not having any real hope for the future, we kind of pick what we know.
Yeah. And by, you know, alongside that, you know, I have a number of volunteers that would help, you know, do transport and walk with people. And they'd come full of enthusiasm, and then about a month later they'd say, this person is not changing.
yeah.
And I'd have to say, look, what we're involved in here is a millimeter ministry.
Right.
And in the sense that, okay, this person can change, but it's going to take years. And if you stay with it and just enjoy the moments, you will start to notice over 5 years or more, this person slowly changing and emerging and unfolding. So don't get hung up by that this person is still in the grips of the addiction or still da 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 da. Give it time and consistency and love, and you will notice a change. And sure enough, you know, these volunteers 5 years down the track, they're still with me. and they're like, wow, this is so good. And I didn't realize how much it's actually changed me.
Right. Yeah, you only can change yourself, right? You can only change yourself.
Yeah, and I've noticed how much this person has changed over the 5 years. I said, that's millimeter ministry. Yeah. Millimeter ministry, just little bits at a time. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I definitely, I was a camp counselor as a teenager, and I definitely thought, you know, I don't know what it is about Christians. Sometimes we don't let Jesus be Jesus. We have to do the Jesus thing part, you know, like, I'll save you. You know, it's all up to me. And I don't know what happens there, but I think, you know, we can't change people. They have to be, there's a lot of resistance there in each one of us. We all have these points of resistance and you have to, you know, agree to the change, and just somebody wanting it for you never really helps. And, you know, even like me as a parent, you know, wanting my teenage son to shave, you know, I can really, really want him to do it, but he's not that enthusiastic, even if I want it more, you know.
Just wait till a pretty girl comes along.
Okay. Well, he does have a pretty girl, but he doesn't think, he's like, it doesn't matter. I said, it might matter. Now he does shower now, so I'm really thankful.
That's more than one millimeter,
I'd say, but it's really true that I can't want that for someone else. And we do a little bit go around thinking, you know, you're great, now change, you know, I want you to change. But it's that the whole point of journeying with somebody is that you're not like, that's that conditional love thing. I'm hoping that you're not the same person tomorrow. I'm hoping that you've improved. it's a little sneaky when you think about it. It's kind of not really a friendship if you're, you know, hoping, well, I'll be a lot happier with you. I'll be a lot more loving towards you, or at least in my heart that I'm seeing some return for my investment.
Yeah, I think Jesus talked about logs in our own eye, didn't he?
Oh my. And so I know you do some other things too with your time. You do some gardening and some other projects too. Did you want to talk anything about those?
Yeah, so what do I do? I decided years ago that I'm a creator. And so most of my time I spend working as a gardener, and I've got quite a few gardens around the Auckland area now. And I suppose my tagline for that is creating places of beauty, rest and provision. And like one of them is a school in a poor area of the city, and they pay me to come in and to run a veggie garden. And the kids come and help me harvest the veggies and plant and all that sort of thing. And my business is called Gumboot Gardening. And do you have gumboots in the States?
I don't know if people just call them rain boots or something, I think. Like wellies, so, like Wellingtons?
Yeah, that's right. So
in England, I guess they call them that.
Yeah, we call them gumboots here in New Zealand. And it's just a funny sort of a name. But if people want to look it up, it's on Facebook, and you'll see lots of pictures of the type of things I do. And then I also do some social media website type freelancing. So I help small businesses with their social media planning and running campaigns and all that sort of stuff. So creating connections with others, that's my buzz line there. And but my heart passion is really within turning the page and mental health. And and I'm hoping that as they grow, I can write more books and provide more income for us as I get that little bit older and less desiring to work out in the hot sun.
Probably want to do that more in, like, not the heat of the day kind of.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, one of the things I hoped we could cover a little bit is pick out a couple of the things from your book called Out of the Darkness. And I know you got these resources elsewhere, and we'll make sure to have a link and credit the author of these. But I thought that these errors in thinking were errors in thinking that people do, whether they have a propensity for depression or not. But as I was reading them, I thought, wow, we can really get stuck in these, and we don't think that this is we don't think of it as an error in thinking. We might just think, I'm having a really crummy day, but we actually don't think that this is like a mind frame and a perspective on the world.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I'll read them out, and then maybe we can pull out one that you think is maybe one that you've done, and I'll pull out one that I think I've done. So there, it's hard to pick, though, I'll tell you that. So
there's
one
so
is,
many that relate to you. Is it right?
I mean, that I've done over the years at one time or another, I can see myself in them.
Yeah.
I think as I'm getting older, I'm not as polarized in this. I think I was maybe much more reactionary growing up, kind of living out of more fear or more protectionary of, you know, of myself and stuff. But one is, the first one is all or nothing thinking, where you think in very black and white categories, all or nothing. The second one is overgeneralization, where you are kind of doing the always or never, you know, something is, we see that that's in a sense, it's a little bit like all or nothing thinking, but, it's like, I'll never get anything right kind of thing. The next one is a mental filter where you take out negative details and dwell on them. And you have an overall sort of darkened view of the world. You might not even realize it. And this is really easy to see in other people. Funny how that works. The fourth one is a disqualifying the positive, which not, you know, it's kind of the opposite of the other one, not really allowing the good points to come out. It's still, or counting them as much as the other stuff. Jumping to conclusions is an interesting one too. When you don't have enough facts to support a conclusion, but you sort of jump to it anyway, instead of just allowing, holding things loosely before you make up your mind about it. This has an A and a B, mind reading. I love that one. you conclude that someone's reacting to you negatively, but you don't bother to check up on it to see if it's right. Don't bother to check it out. Fortune teller error. Oh my gosh. I've definitely done this one. I might have to pick this one out. You anticipate the things that will turn out badly and you feel convinced that your prediction is already an established fact. Yeah. Cause I think I sometimes have thought, you know, I'm so intuitive. I know what's going on. I know what they're thinking. And I've done that. And I've been, you know, sometimes half right. And, you know, if you think you're half right, you think, well, you know, I'm, you know, I don't know if you play cricket or baseball or both in New Zealand, but if you're getting like 3 hits out of 10 in baseball, professional American baseball, you're doing well. You know, 3 out of 10 is terrible. But, you know, if I get 3 out of 10 correct answers on my fortune telling, I think I'm pretty awesome too. You know? let's see, magnifying or catastrophizing or minimizing
emotional reasoning.
Things are getting blown out. You assume that your negative emotions necessarily reflect the way things really are, therefore it must be true. Should statements. You try to motivate yourself with shoulds and shouldn'ts, as if you had to be whipped and punished before you could be expected to do anything. Must and oughts.
Hey, please stop shoulding on yourself.
Stop shoulding on yourself. That can really get you into like a shame spiral. There was a period of time where you know, I was like really beating myself up and no one else was, you know, for some reason I thought I deserved a little bit of a, like slapping myself around. I don't know what that was about, but you don't really realize you're doing it sometimes. And until you can kind of take a step back and look back in on your life and wonder, you know, what am I wasting all that energy instead of just like, okay, I'm going to turn the page. I'm going to not continue to do the same energy wasting things anymore, because it's definitely not helping me. Labeling and mislabeling. I'm a loser. And different, you know, I'm stupid, I'm a loser, all those things that you can say to abuse yourself, essentially.
Yeah. Personalization.
Let's see if I'm getting this right. Blame. You see yourself as the cause of some negative external event in which, in fact, you are not primarily responsible for. Self-blaming can lead to anger at yourself and feeling much worse.
Yeah.
You know, that one, maybe you can explain that one for me, because is that where you would take the blame for something that had nothing to do with you, like a event? I'm trying to think of. I can see how a child would do this. I'm trying to think of how an adult would do this. I mean, I'm sure it happens. I'm just like in my head trying to.
Taking responsibility for other people's problems. It's like, I did. They like that because I did this. And actually, no. Actually, they need to take responsibility for what they did, not you.
That actually happens quite a bit when you say it like that. I was thinking more like my parents got divorced because I was bad, or you know, he beats me because I was asking for it, or something. But actually, when you think of it, like if someone failed at something, you know, that you didn't step in, or that you didn't do something when somebody's behavior is their own responsibility, then that codependency thing that happens sometimes can be a lot of personalization.
And it also really exacerbates when someone says, yeah, it was your fault that I did that.
Oh, yeah. Let me back that up for you. let me throw a little gasoline on that fire you made for yourself. There's a lot of good ones here, and I bet we could almost spend an episode on each one. But of all of those, there's 11. And when people sign up for your website, and they can read all of them in depth and kind of figure all of them out. But of all of those, which one kind of made the biggest impression on you, or you felt like, oh, I see myself doing that one? Which one would it be for you?
All of them.
You can't do that. That's cheating.
I think for me, and is I will magnify, or I will just go to the worst possible case scenario if something hits me, right? So I will think, you know, this small thing happens, then I do a massive big jump to the end conclusion that I've decided that this is what will happen. And so I have to pull myself back in, you know, and just say, hold on, no, that's not necessarily true. We take one step at a time. This is just a little blip. Let's keep going. So speaking to myself the truth, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, that reminds me that this is really another good reason to have plenty of people in your life to make sure you're not isolated, because usually these bad errors, these thinking errors, happen in isolation. I think when you're, at least for me, I could say that when I've thought these things and I didn't check them out with anybody else I trusted or a friend, and I said, you know, I feel like this. This is what I feel like. They would probably say, "It kind of makes sense that you would think that," but I don't see it like that. I would probably correct a little bit.
Yeah, or they would ask empowering questions like, "Are you sure that's correct? Have you got evidence to back that up?
Yeah.
What's another perspective of looking at that?
Yeah.
Those sorts of empowering type questions.
Right. And it's tricky if you're already isolated for some reason that you can't control. And I think in those cases, I know for me, when I was away at college, I had plenty of friends, but like no one I could really at least no one I felt like I could really bare my heart to least for a period of time. And I was journaling a lot, though, so I could put everything down in a journal and then go back and look at it and realize, well, that sounds crazy. It sounds, you know, it sounds like errors in my thinking. It sounds like I'm catastrophizing. Yeah. It sounds like either overthinking or mislabeling or something. And sometimes you can look back in at something you wrote a week prior and say, is this, you know, ask it questions, ask yourself questions. But if you don't kind of get it out somehow, it's really hard to, it gets very circular when it just stays up in your brain.
Yeah. And I think journaling is a great way of sort of just mind dumping the other brain into onto paper. And one of my writing projects in the future is I think I want to write a book called Write Your Way to Mental Health.
Yeah.
You know, and explore that whole use of written stuff to just to clarify your thinking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and there's something about different about writing in longhand. I did a podcast recently. Have you noticed that too?
I've set a goal for this year. My only goal is to write 300 words with pen and paper every day.
Yeah. Well, it's slower than typing. For most people. Yeah. Some people just, like my husband just pecks with like two fingers at the typing, but he's still pretty darn fast for just those two fingers. But there's something different about writing in longhand that your brain catches up a little bit, you know.
You're engaging in a different part of your brain, basically.
Right. You are, and the movement of your hand, and
that's right.
Something, there's other parts of other neurons, networks firing, and I think it comes out differently. And maybe it's good to do all of that, like maybe type out a little bit somewhere on a document, and maybe write a little bit out, and maybe talk to a friend. Maybe doing all those things would engage different neural networks and get things really flowing better. But I think what is probably the most damaging and dangerous is thinking that you can keep it all in your head and it won't somehow damage you. As if your brain can somehow sort that all out. And I think that's why people run into sleeping problems and even like tension headaches and migraines and things like that, because you can't really handle it. Your brain just keeps trying and trying and trying to figure it out with no break, no real way to get rid of any of that or sort it out alone.
That's right. Yeah. And often what I do is for a blog post, I'll write it all out in hand, and then I'll write it into, type it into my blog. You know, and it's just really powerful just to get it out in a written form first.
And that also feeds into having a spiritual director or coach or therapist to meet with regularly. Have you ever done anything like that with a spiritual director or anything of that sort?
I haven't done it as a personal exercise, but something a counsellor does with me is he actually writes out all his notes for me, and then he gives me a copy at the end of the session.
Oh, wow.
And so I go home with a complete set of notes, and so I can keep on writing, or I can keep on just reading them, or, rehearsing some of the exercises and things that we talked about.
Wow. That's brilliant, because
it is brilliant.
You can just talk without filter or without having to think about taking anything down. And
that's right.
Yeah, that's, and then there's a secretary there figuring it all out, and then you can just revisit it later with different eyes.
That's right.
That's really smart. I think, these kind of reflective things, I don't know if, I hope we're not moving into a time where no one reflects anymore, but I have some concerns that we're moving into a time where people are losing the skill to reflect, or even just setting apart any time to properly reflect, because what appears to happen is that, at least in my surroundings, anywhere you go, there's a television or people are on their phones. And so in any line that you're in where someone might carry on a conversation with someone else or just have their thoughts, or in a waiting room, there's always a TV or someone's on their phone. And so when are there ever times to reflect? And I think that will contribute to some increased mental illness.
Yeah.
How does the brain rest? And at night, during sleep, other things go on. You're supposed to have time in the day for that also, and it's not just during sleep. So I wonder if there will be more instances. I mean, to me, it's no surprise that, at least in the United States, there's a huge opiate problem, and that marijuana is getting legalized everywhere, and there's a, you know, a lot of addiction to painkillers and food, yeah. things like this, because something is trying. People are trying to anesthetize and numb themselves from the pain of not being able to reflect, essentially. And I'm guilty too. I'm not like, well, if everyone were like me, you know. But I think that that's just kind of a cultural issue that we have to be kind of. We have to be honest about it and say, I don't think we're healthy. And there's some reasons why we could probably do something about it. But our brain doesn't do very well without recollection.
Yeah. I came up with a little line years and years ago. And it's this: still candles burn brighter. Still candles burn brighter. And so if you imagine your life is like being a candle, okay, and you're running around like we do, you know, that little flame, it gets knocked around and it diminishes and it goes down and it gets down and it gets down and it gets down, and hardly any light's been shown, all right? But if you put a candle still, and that flame will burst up and get bigger and bigger and bigger and provide more brightness, all right? And I think it's important for all of us to find some stillness in our life, a place where we can just reflect and just be quiet and still and listen.
Mm. Well, do you find that when you're working in your gardening, or do you find that in different ways?
Well, certainly, yeah, in the gardening, you can have lots of little moments of just being still and enjoying a flower or a bee, or when it doesn't sting you. all sorts of ways of finding that stillness. But even when you're not, it's a discipline. It's a thing you have to carve time out and make it a priority. And it can be as simple as just taking a few short breaths and being quiet. Something I love to do is I love to listen to another podcast called Sacred Pilgrim. And in Sacred Pilgrim, Laura, she does this thing called Lectio Divina, where she takes a passage of scripture or a spiritual reading and she just reads meditatively through it. And it's just a very much a stilling time of just focusing down on what the scripture might be saying to you. So it's a lovely little habit that I've got into. Yeah. Mm,
yeah. I've been enjoying it. Similarly, it's similarly set up is Pray As You Go with the Jesuits. And yeah, it's the app called Pray As You Go. And it's real similar to where there's little music at the beginning and then a short reading and a time of reflection. It's like at the most, it may be 12 minutes, but it's usually in the 8 to 12 minute range.
Yeah.
And then they always ask questions of you. So there's a reflection built in. There's a reflection time built in. And then they read the scripture again, and then there's music again. And so you don't have to plan anything. You can just press play. And I'd like that it's prepared. Every single day is different and it's prepared ahead of time. So you just have to decide to tune in. And, I don't have to do it every day. It's just if I can do something different, because sometimes I like the variety and not feel like I'm bound to do something. And, maybe the next day I could just light a candle and watch it and breathe. Or maybe the next day I could do a little prayer walk or something. But that's to try to be mindful that to not stay in my head. I'm just a person who has, a lot of thoughts and energy and imagination, and I can tend to live a bit in my head and forget to come back into my body and breathe and okay, now time to breathe. Why is this thing hurting me that I didn't notice all day? Like I stubbed my toe and I didn't realize it. There's these things that will bring me back and center me again and allow me to reflect. And I think for me anyway, I need those reminders and those prompts to reflect or I will get just carried right downstream culturally and with my personality. Yep. And I'll just whoosh, and then I'll be gone downstream with everybody else.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, is there any final thoughts you have for my listeners? Anything you would encourage them in or direct them to on your site?
Well, we'll provide plenty of links in your show notes. But I would just encourage them to connect deeply with a few special other people. For the last, maybe 10, 12 years, I've been meeting with a couple of guys, just two other guys, every Thursday for lunch, and where we just talk about absolutely nothing at all. But we build deep relationships. And for me, I think that's the closest to what I think Jesus talked about as what we know of as church, really. You know, those places where either two or three are gathered, I'm going to show up and have a party. And I think that's the biggest thing that someone can do for their mental health, is have two or three others just that you meet regularly with, and you just spend time just talking and sharing life. Yeah.
Totally agree. Totally agree. Yeah, we are. We can't deny our nature, our social nature, and I think it's Larry Crabb that talks about God as community.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
Right, and triune God is triune God, which is in itself an incredible mystery. I think Christians will often treat God more like Zeus, and we actually don't really live a Trinitarian. We don't necessarily embody or incarnate a Trinitarian view of the divine.
That's right.
But if we did really fully embody that, we would see a lot of people, ordinary people and people who really struggle, have much better mental health, because we'd be so much more connected.
That's right.
Relying on each other in good ways. And it can be messy. It's not like everybody's got their weirdness. You know, everybody's got their problems and their little things that are quirks and to them. But at the same time, if we're not connected, we're really just sort of stuck in our own little worlds and our own little heads.
And that's right.
Your reminder is such a good one.
Good.
Can you tell everybody where to find you on social media and the internet?
Okay, so best place is to go to my website, which is turningthepage.info. And you'll find all the social links there. I'm mostly on Twitter, which is at Barry, it's B-A-R-R-Y, Pearman, P-E-A-R-M-A-N.
Yep, and Twitter's how I found you. And I'm very grateful for your encouragement to me with this podcast, and the friendship we've gotten over Twitter and the encouragement. It's been really a blessing to me, and I'm grateful that you could come on my show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful. Yeah.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.